Hello. It's nice to see you all. I'm glad to be with you today. I'm just taking a minute to look through the faces on the screen. It's a little harder to make connections in this space or to feel our connection, so nothing wrong with looking around and seeing who you're with, letting it in. That we are together. I invite you to use your imagination. Imagine you are walking down the street and deeply feeling the earth on the soles of your feet and hearing the sound of the leaves on the ground as you walk through them and in the air. There, and you arrive somewhere and put on your mask. There's a line of people and you stand together. And then someone hands you a piece of paper and a pen and directs you to a little booth. And you look down at the piece of paper and it's covered in black marks on white, which you know to be letters and words, the names of people which you have studied and learned about and considered. And next to the names there are little ovals. You take a pen and you fill out some ovals informed by your commitment to being aware of what's happening in the world. And then you take a piece of paper and you put it in a little machine that eats it up. Ooh. And then you walk back outside, free to choose the next beneficial course of action. Right here amidst the total evidence of your senses and your heart and your mind. Pretty simple! Pretty simple. We can find just the doing of each thing. That is possible. And of course, voting is something I encourage. If you haven't voted yet, you should know that there's been a court ruling that basically makes it so that the only way to vote right now is, I think you can vote in person or you can vote early voting, but absentee ballots, the counting method has been altered. And so, you don't want to mail absentee ballots at this point. Anyway, voting is good. And yeah, you can just do it. And it's interesting because it's such a simple act, you know, like you just, it takes you about 1 minute. You fill out these little ovals, but it seems so momentous, right? You leave you know, I don't know about you, but I'm like, oh my goodness, is the person that I voted for going to be elected or not? Make it very momentous. And then many times, you know, after the outcome of the election occurs, I've been very dejected or very elated. And this is very normal. That's good. You know, we can find that simplicity, and that helps us to come back to just choosing to do what we can do that will be a benefit. Now, on the one hand, it's like an election is a big deal. You know, it is. It's a really big deal. It's very influential, and it affects people's lives really profoundly. But on the other hand, it's just a apparent momentary occurrence that's produced by an unbelievably vast amount of conditions. And so, you know, generally speaking, in Zen, we're invited to hold both of these perspectives. To hold both of these perspectives and notice when we've sort of fallen over into one. So, although in Zen we have this huge emphasis on just taking care of the immediate act in front of you with your whole being, which could be learning about something or advocating for something or sweeping a floor or breathing or cooking. looking at the ceiling as you prepare to fall asleep. All these. But it's, you know, Zen doesn't like deny the importance of our need to recognize things as important. We have like beautiful and complex rituals that take a lot of work to construct, that where we honor people's commitment to things. We have initiation ceremonies, ordinations. We have services every morning to remind us and highlight the value of our individual, every moment's individual act, but also to kind of coalesce all that and say, this moment, this particular moment of doing this ritual has particular power. We're honoring that. In the Dhammapada, it says, victory begets enmity. The defeated dwell in pain. Happily, the peaceful live, discarding both victory and defeat. So the thing is, we're likely to think of an election in terms of victory and defeat, but you could also just say it, someone has been elected. They didn't beat anybody and they didn't win. Although the Dhammapada, which is like, you know, a distillation of early Buddhist teaching, says victory begets enmity, the defeated dwell in pain, happily the peaceful live, discarding both victory and defeat. The Pali Canon is enormously characterized by occasions where people come to the Buddha and argue with him. And he enters that relationship with them, and the stories tend to turn out, because these are religious texts, the Buddha helps someone to see something really different than they saw before. And often it's an argument. I mean, you read the thing, you're like, these people are arguing. No doubt about it. But you don't get the feeling that Buddha is like, ha ha, I won. It doesn't have to be winning and losing. We can begin to recognize that every single moment is a creative and collaborative activity between whatever we are and whatever has arisen here. And we can keep returning to that. When we fill out a little oval, when we walk down the street, we say, What am I doing with this walking down the street? Wouldn't it be valuable to just pour my whole energy into being present to it and feeling it and letting it in? So this way of recognizing that every moment is this opportunity to be, to really recognize we're in relationship, and it's a collaboration where we're creatively engaging with the universe moment to moment. This is refuge. This is refuge. When you begin to really find this, you can begin to feel, this is where I belong. This is the most real and radical safety that is available to me. The theme of my talk today is going for refuge. Going for refuge. I think my editor, the literary editor I work with, would probably say I buried the lead, but that's okay. Here we are, going for refuge. You know, going for refuge is a central idea throughout Buddhist literature, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which, you know, in the original literature, that meant, you know, just going for refuge in the actual teacher, the person who was known as Buddha, the Dharma, which is the body of teaching, and the Sangha, which is the community of practitioners in that literature, specifically Buddhist practitioners. So refuge is on my mind, one, because I'm co-leading a study group on refuge with Minna Jan, and right now with MZMC and a bunch of other people who are here. I see them, love you. And also because I think people, a lot of people are feeling a need for refuge. From a practical perspective, this is the most socially or culturally difficult, fraught, and painful time I have ever seen. I'm only 50 years old. and it's only my perspective, but the pandemic we're living in, I've never experienced anything like it. I mean, I'm a Zen guy. I could say I've never experienced anything like anything else, but I've never experienced anything like this, people. It's really a trip. And the enormous upsurge of energy for transformation of our society to disrupt oppressive systems and the massive backlash against that is like nothing I've ever seen. What I saw in Minneapolis as I talked to people, as we convened meetings, as I marched in the streets earlier this year was enormous. Now, I talked to many people who were alive in 1968 and they often said, this is pretty familiar to me. But I had not been born. And that's a while ago, everybody. It's quite a while ago. So the Buddhist teaching of starting with the idea of refuge, like you enter the path by taking refuge, is it's indicative of the profound psychological insight of early Buddhism. People need to feel safe. It's a deep human psychological need and the basis on which transformation can happen. And we need collectively to create a context where people can feel safe. So the idea is we get to choose that, like, you know what, where I feel like I'm going to go find my sense of safety and where I'm starting to feel it is in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. These teachings really feel like they are working for me. This teacher, I feel like I can trust and will support me. This community of people, I feel like I can trust and will support me. And no, you don't have to make that choice. That's one of my favorite things about Buddhism. It's not like thou shalt. Oh, sorry. You must take refuge. It's just like you can choose to take refuge. Does this ring true to you? And for many people, when we make this act, we feel it. We feel it. So one of the really weird things about this, though, is you go, okay, I'm going to go for refuge. This is where I'm going to get my sense of safety. And then basically the thing is the Dharma says, yeah, there's no real safety. Where I'm inviting you to find your safety is recognizing that the world is constantly changing. There's nothing you can really hold on to. Anything that you try and grasp or keep will not prevail. And what you're invited into is find refuge in something much deeper than anything you can get, gain, control, or get rid of. I just can't resist reading this line from the Vimalakirti Sutra. Vimalakirti is like this intensely, he's really into challenging your regular way of looking at things. I'll put it that way. The Dharma is not a secure refuge. He who enjoys a secure refuge in the Dharma is not interested in the Dharma. He's interested in a secure refuge. So, yes, we need to feel safe. But if that safety comes by shoring up our defenses, by holding on, we will be constructing a refuge which is insecure. It's a sandcastle. The waves lap the beach of truth. We can find a refuge which is just, here's this. I'm in the midst of it. I have an offering. If you look at the Four Noble Truths, you'll see this. It says we're in samsara and we can always do something beneficial. Although this time is the most, from my perspective, the most difficult culturally and social time I've ever seen, there have been many, many much worse ones in human history. I don't even want to go into it. So much. And people have been able to stand up and find ways, or sit down, or lie down, and find ways to offer something beneficial. This is the refuge. This is the refuge. I'm going to do a little visualization thing in a minute. I guess I started with a visualization too. I just want to talk about visualization for a minute. The Dhammapada starts by saying our life is created by mind. Whoa, that's not the way I usually think of it. But to say this in real simple terms, I would say Buddhism and Yogacara, which I generally base my teachings on, Yogacara Buddhism, really emphasize that what we experience matters. It really matters. If you're experiencing things in this way, even though it may disagree with how someone else is experiencing it or how the objective world is, it really matters. And the way someone else is experiencing it, even if you totally disagree with them, really matters, because that's the only way they access reality. No one accesses reality outside of the way they're experiencing it right now. And the place that liberative activity is possible, that healing is possible, that a creative, collaborative engagement with what is possible is now. So visualization is de-emphasized in Zen, but in some schools is used a lot. And coming out of the Yogacara and into the Tibetan, it's used like a whole lot. They're really amazing, wonderful visualization practices. And you know what these show? They show the power of mind. So 1800 years ago, Buddhists were like, wow, you know, if you visualize this thing and you experience it, it will condition your mind to have that kind of experience. Pretty simple. And so they were like, well, what if you just picture loving people a lot? You'll start loving people more. It's cool. What if you, picture beloved people standing next to you? You might feel supported. It's possible. And this has been, borne out extensively with, science. Science agrees with this basic idea. You know, it's pretty well done. You know, it's like if you sit around and think about something that's really stressful to you, your body starts making all the same stress hormones it makes as if that thing is present in your direct sensory experience. One of the more amazing ones is when they figured out that people who have some training in playing basketball, it's like actually practicing shooting free throws is very similar in outcome in how much it improves your free throwing. As just visualizing, really carefully visualizing free throwing correctly. This is why in sports, it's very, very common. It's pretty standard to use visualization exercises because they just work. If you create in your mind something, it conditions the mind. So anyway, that's just, we're getting somewhere with this. I will be inviting you to do some visualizing. Now, the visualization I want to do, is a practice called the seven homecomings that we have been, using in the Going for Refuge study group. And, the seven homecomings is a practice that was, made up, I think, is being promoted, but I think it is a creation of, Lama Rod Owens. Lama Rod's a wonderful teacher, a contemporary teacher. And Lama Rod is the co-author of the book Radical Dharma, which really emphasizes talking about the experience of being Black and Buddhist in the United States, which has often been very fraught for many people because of the prevailing, unacknowledged white culture of many Buddhist sanghas. So that book is a really great invitation to really investigate the racialized nature of our communities and learn to be genuinely inclusive. And Lama Rod, his newest book is called Love and Rage. And I haven't read the whole thing. I've only read parts. But one thing I'm struck by this book is one of my all-time most inspiring favorite human beings is Bell Hooks, who's a Buddhist and one of the architects of what we think of as intersectional feminist liberation theory. And Bell Hooks, one of her books is called Killing Rage. And then she's also black. And then Ruth King, who is just like a radiant being of love and liberation, who is also black, has a book called Healing Rage. But I'm like, wow, three of the most prominent black Buddhists in the world all have books with rage in their title. What does this tell you? It tells you something about something people are feeling. So, and we all need refuge. So my sense is those teachers all recognize that people like them who are black experience a lot of rage living in this culture. And so they need refuge. And refuge begins by being honest about what's going on. Just starting there. Starting there. And, you know, you might be like, well, I don't experience a lot of rage, or I can't identify with that, or I don't think, why should we be talking about that? That's all. Your perspective. I'll come back to where each person's perspective is the only place they have the possibility for engaging in liberation and healing. Buddhist practice. What this also makes me think of, because I haven't seen a lot of Buddhist books by white people with rage in the title, is that we're different. There are differences. And it's good to be real about that. One of the greatest books I've read in the last several years is Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, who's a civil rights attorney. And there's a really good movie too, but the book's even better. He's a great writer. But in it, he says, we all share the condition of brokenness. We all share the condition of brokenness. We have all been hurt, and we have all hurt somebody. We all share this condition of brokenness, even though our brokenness may not be equivalent. Sounds a little bit like acknowledging that we're all in samsara, and we all experience it in our own particular way. And we can do something. And it helps to do something by starting with finding refuge, which is why I want to now lead the seven homecomings practice, which Lama Rod created. And this practice will be a visualization, guided visualization meditation practice. So I'm just going to invite you to find whatever posture you like for meditation. This will probably be about 15 minutes. And this will be eyes closed meditation. Visualization meditations generally are. So usually I suggest when meditating that you turn so you're not looking straight at the camera, but it's in your field of vision. So like on Zoom, we can connect with each other, know if something weird has happened, but we're not being constantly stimulated by it. So for Zazen, which is an eye open meditation, that's optimum. But since your eyes are going to be closed, you'll probably be fine here wherever you're looking. So I just invite you to settle the awareness in the body. Just notice your own physical sensations, perhaps grounding in the breath, the first foundation of mindfulness, and what is called in Yogacara access to calm abiding, the breath. And as I go through these invitations, you know, you can visualize. So that's actually trying to picture with your mind visually. Or you can engage any of your other senses with imagination. Or you can also just sort of evoke the feelings or even just cognitive thoughts about what I'm bringing you to. So for some people, visualizing, they actually find it stressful because they're like, I can't picture anything. I must be doing it wrong. That's fine. People's ways of imagining and internally creating images is quite various. So just trust your own process. So I'm going to invite you to the first homecoming is coming home to a guide or guides. So I'm just going to invite you to think of someone that has been a great support for you, like a loving, wise person who has been there for you. And they don't have to be perfect. It could be a couple people, that's fine. But just bring those people into your mind. Try and create a sense of their presence with you now. Notice in particular whatever feelings arise. Let them in. Can try and paint the internal image of this person more and more vividly. What are the sounds? What a scene. Is there touch? Let's just let this visualization go and just rest the mind for a moment in the body and the breath. Now let's come home to a text that we find or texts that we find supportive and encouraging, be a body of literature, or a poem, or a book, or a sutra, some words. Maybe you've only heard them and never seen them written. Just call to mind. May you find supportive, a refuge, a place to come home to. Let's just let this particular imagination go. Notice this breath. So let's find in our minds a community of homecoming. So whatever sense of community, there may be many, that's fine. Just begin to let it bubble up into your imagination, visualizing, hearing, smelling, tasting. Community that is a coming home for you. Let's let this visualization go. Go with the imagination. Notice the breath in the body. The quality of your heart. Let us find homecoming in ancestors, those who have come before, could be ancestors in your family, but you may not know them, these spiritual ancestors, whoever it is that to you provides a sense of homecoming. People before were still there for you. You can think of many individuals, or one. And let's let this imagination go. Rest here in the body as it is experienced now. And let us find homecoming now in the earth. Just feeling the ground right now. That which is always supporting you. Feeling it at the points of contact. But also, if you'd like, visualizing the earth in whatever way feels to you like a homecoming, maybe a place where you feel grounded, you feel the actuality of your earthness. Let's go of this imagination. Rest in the breath. The sixth homecoming is silence. I invite you to just come home to a place of no words. Seventh homecoming, the self, coming home to your own embodied experience, sensations in the body, quality of the heart, the mind, coming home where nothing must be destroyed or gotten rid of. There are not parts of yourselves that are disowned. All is included. Coming home to the self. Open the eyes, reorient yourself to the sensory environment and the group of people here in this Dharma occurrence. So I have really enjoyed engaging this practice that Lama Rod Owens brings to us, and having enjoyed it in many ways, just thought in my life about how I can create a sense of being at home. I know the funny thing is, you know, it's like people have a deep need for home, but now everyone is grumpy because they're at home all the time. Because we're complicated. Human beings are pretty complicated. But there's a simplicity that is available. Just come and say, oh, I feel a little shut in or a little sad. There's a simplicity in just being there. Or listening to another person whose experience is different. They're like, this has been great. I haven't had to talk to anyone in 6 months. I'm an introvert. We're all different. It's okay. And I'm all different. I'm different than I was 2 minutes ago. Surprise. This collaboration with what's arising is a collaboration with the whole, whatever I am, whatever this is. Creativity. One of my favorite things that's happened in many years is I was giving a talk in a Buddhist temple in Ohio, and a really super hep-cat jazz musician, like obviously a beatnik in the 50s, came up, and he was like, yeah, I learned later he's an extremely accomplished and somewhat famous drummer, and he said, man, I don't know anything about Zen, but you're just talking about jazz. Like, when someone comes to my door, I open the door and we do jazz. I also just gotta say, I felt these seven homecomings very deeply, because I do the Soto Zen service, usually 3 days a week. Just 3 days a week most of the time nowadays, sometimes two. I've been doing that for 10 years or something. Used to be 1 or 2 days a week, 1 day a week, 0 days a week. But in that ritual, all these homecomings are deeply embedded. We invoke our guides. We call in the teachers who have been there for us. We chant texts out loud. We do this ritual in community. The main reason I do the ritual, I didn't want to do rituals. I just wanted to be with people who were doing Zazen. I do it with real people who are in this group. We invoke the ancestors, especially on Saturday. We like list, like, I don't know, the number, 80, 90 more ancestors. We call them in. The earth, we find homecoming the earth. I mean, we like get down on the ground if we're physically able and put our faces on the earth. We touch it. And there's not a whole lot of silence in the ceremony, but I feel like we make up for it with the hour of Zazen beforehand. And of course, Buddhism is about realizing no self and the non-self nature of all phenomena, but that only happens immediately here when we come home to whatever the self is. No self and self are identical. That doesn't mean self isn't no self, or no self isn't self. It means something more mysterious that can only be found when we really settle. Come to Zazen. Join this practice. Come to Rohatsu. It's possible to really settle. Settle in to refuge, which is whatever this is, plus whatever I'm gonna jump into with it right now. Don't even have to jump. You're already completely immersed. Thank you all for your kind attention.